My guest today is Arina Yaminska, a young woman from the Ukraine who started solo traveling in her late teens. Her journey and experiences have included things like hitchhiking away to Iraq. She's been to countries such as Iran, Tajikistan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Israel. And most importantly, I'm interested in talking to her about her latest project, which is shooting a documentary series throughout her time and travels in the country of Pakistan.
This episode is brought to you by Egypt Fun Tours. If you're a fan of Indiana Jones and dream of exploring ancient ruins and uncovering hidden treasures, then Egypt Fun Tours is the perfect choice for you. As you journey through Egypt, you'll feel like you're on your own personal adventure. With Egypt Fun Tours, you'll have the opportunity to explore some of the world's most iconic archaeological sites, including the Pyramids of Giza, the Valley of the Kings, and the Temple of Karnak. Their expert guides will take you off the beaten path and show you the hidden gems that most tourists never get to see. Whether you're exploring the underground tombs of ancient pharaohs or walking in the footsteps of Cleopatra, you'll feel like you've stepped into a Hollywood movie. And with their attention to detail and commitment to authenticity, Egypt Fun Tours ensures that you'll have an experience that's both thrilling and educational. So if you're ready to embark on an adventure of a lifetime, look no further than Egypt Fun Tours. Book your tour today and get ready to uncover the mysteries of Egypt like never before. For more information on Egypt Fun Tours, check out their Facebook page, Egypt Fun Tours, and their website, EgyptFunTours.com.
This episode is also brought to you by Delhi's Continental, the newest addition to the local food scene in Perth, Western Australia. A Conti bar like no other, this hip and trendy spot offers a unique twist on classic Conti rolls, crafted with the highest quality ingredients and culinary expertise. With a passion for bringing elevated flavors to casual dining, Delhi's Continental Creative Menu is sure to satisfy any palate. Whether you're craving a classic Conti roll with a gourmet twist or a doorstopper focaccia, this Conti bar is the perfect spot for foodies. Come and experience the culinary mastery of the talented staff at Delhi's Continental, the hottest new Conti bar in town. 2, 861 Beaufort Street, Inglewood. For more information, you can check out their Instagram and Facebook page, Delhi's_Continental.
What I want to get to first is when I first met you, what I remember that was so interesting is, one, that you're from Ukraine, but you traveled at quite an early age, but to countries that people don't necessarily travel to, especially if they're a girl alone. Can you tell me how that started? And as a young girl, what inspired you to travel?
I have always been extremely curious about the world. And when I was a teenager back in Ukraine, we had a fashion for self-development, traveling, budget traveling, adventurous traveling. And we had many young people share their experiences about how to travel when you're young. You have no money, but you really want to see the world. And that really appealed to me. So one day I joined this open talk of a woman who hitchhiked all the way from Ukraine to India. And she told us about services like couch surfing, about how to hitchhike, about how to meet new people, how to survive in situations where you don't know what happens tomorrow. And as a 16-year-old young girl, I thought to myself, wow, if she can do it, if she can travel all the way to India on her own, maybe I can try and visit a neighboring country, which was Slovakia. And ever since that first trip at 17, it felt like the addiction of traveling never left my body. And
Why do you think that is? I know, you know, we call it the travel bug. What was that bug for you? Was it a form of escapism from the norm that you knew, the sense of adventure, of new things that you discover, or was it the people?
It's more like adrenaline addiction. Because the kind of traveling I have started was a journey that never had an ending point. So My parents were quite worried about me, I have to admit. But I have been addicted to the adrenaline of discovering the world, of understanding people, understanding cultures, seeing how much I can handle and survive. And it started from easy places like Europe, travel by bus, spend $10 on a plane. And then it took me to more adventurous places like Middle East, Arabic countries, Iraq. And
this lady that you went to see, how old was she?
I think at the time she must have been 21.
Oh, so she was quite young too.
Yeah.
Was she from Ukraine or?
Yes, she was.
Oh, she traveled from Ukraine to India. She hitchhiked.
Yes.
Okay, so she was quite an inspiration. And she was in your sort of, I know you were 17, so in your sort of age bracket. What was the, you went to Slovenia, but when you said to me, for the people listening, I actually said that I'm a traveler too, and these are the countries I wanted to travel to. And you responded and you said, yeah, I've been there. And it was countries like Iraq, Iran, because I love ancient history, and that's the Persian Empire, the Babylon. And I was naming off these countries and you'd been to them and you said that you'd been on your own. And that I was straight away interested because I wanted to know the stories of, one, why you went to Iran, why you went to Iraq, and also your experiences there. So I think we'll start with, did you go to Iran first or Iraq?
I went to Iraq first.
You went to Iraq. Okay. So tell me about, how long did you go for? What age were you?
First, I would like to answer your question about how did I come up with the idea to come to Iraq?
Yeah.
Because that's a good story. So one day I was thinking to myself, okay, I feel like I had enough of Europe and now I want to go somewhere really, really adventurous. And I looked at the map and I was looking, and then I see this country, Iraq. And I was like, ah, oh, this is a place where other people don't go. This is interesting. So I started researching more and more about the country and about the travelers who go there. And that's how I met one of my close friends, who is a traveler who inspired me for many, many more really adventurous countries. I went to Iraq for 2 weeks. I was 19 years old, and the journey was a hitchhiking trip for 4,000 kilometers from Italy all the way to northern Iraq.
Hitchhiked?
Yes.
Yeah. And so what were some of the experiences, one, hitchhiking, and two, was Iraq what you thought it would be?
Back then, the image of Iraq was a really dangerous country that ISIS used to be part of. And 6 years ago, going to Iraq was still really unsafe and unpopular. Right now, you can get a visa to Iraq really easily. But back then, I only got a visa to the Kurdish part of Iraq, which is northern part.
Sure. What were the people there like?
Iraqi people are super cool. They love having fun. They love to sing. They like to dance. They are very hospitable, very accommodative people, conservative, and they love to share food. When you order a salad in Iraq, all of a sudden it comes with 3 extra salads, juice, and some nuts.
It's food. Well, food is the culture.
Yes.
Especially in the Middle East, I found, with
it's
the countries that I went to. And there is a sense of hospitality that you don't get in a lot of other countries. And I shouldn't say a lot of other countries, a lot of Western countries. You don't find that level of hospitality. I can imagine it being the same in South America. But I know especially in Greece, you know, back to old mythology, there was a thing called, I think it was called Xenia. And it was about, if a traveler comes to your country, it's your obligation. You have to give them, be inviting. You have to give them food. You have to give them accommodation and offer them. And, you know, it was when Zeus was there, he said it was one of his main rules that you have to obey. And I know that a lot of the cultures have taken that on, that sort of sense of Xenia love, like if you're in my country, I'm going to share my country with you mm-hmm. and give you whatever you needed. Have you found that through most of the Middle Eastern countries you've been to?
Most of Middle Eastern countries are Muslim countries and they're very conservative countries. And as part of what Islam teaches is that people accept guests as gift from God. And that means they treat you with utmost respect. People treat you with a lot of kindness, generosity and hospitality. They share their food with you. And it's not uncommon to get an invitation from a stranger from the street or from a shared taxi saying, come visit my home, stay with my family.
Yeah. And what was, I know it's a beautiful country because I know an ex-student of mine from Iraq mm-hmm. and he used to go back, you know, to visit his family quite a lot. And I found them sort of similar to the Persians, to the Iranians for me. But what were some of the negative, you know, experiences that you learned traveling as a single girl? Because you were a girl, basically.
I still am a woman.
Yeah, you're a woman now, but back, you know, we're talking like when you were 17, 18, right?
Yeah, 19, yeah.
19, yeah. So was there any negative experiences that you found when you went to, like, let's say, Iraq?
When I just entered the border with Iraq, I was super exhausted. It was a long bus ride and you can just imagine crossing into Iraq. And from the media's perspective, it's an extremely dangerous place to be. So you get this adrenaline rush and I didn't sleep all night. And I have been really hungry. So I went to this place that sells street salad and I said to myself, okay, I can have some of that. Next thing you know, I was food poisoned.
Oh, with your first meal. Oh, God.
Yeah. So that wasn't great, but I recovered in one day, which was good. The air in Iraq is not fresh. It's full of dust and oil. Iraq has a certain smell to it. But in terms of negative experiences, I can tell you a few. But it doesn't just have to be in Iraq.
Yeah, no, it's just I love travel anyway. So one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you was to get travel experiences. And, you know, I've had on a person here that travels for a living, but they do a bit more conservative travel. So, you know, they, because they're sponsored and they've been to some pretty hairy places, but nothing like Iraq, Iran and, you know, things like that. So, for me, I would like to get those experiences, you know, some of those negative experiences and the positive experiences. Before we hit your, you know, what you've been recently working on in your documentary. So for me, I'd love to go to Iraq someday and I'd like to go visit, you know, especially the old where Babylon was. And I do know that Saddam Hussein has rebuilt a lot of Nebuchadnezzar's castle there. So they're saying that a lot of it is Saddam's building. It's not some of the ancient sites, but you still have some of the ancient sites there. But they've got a fantastic museum, I've heard. So, yeah, I would like to go to Iraq and I'd like to learn more about it from you in a selfish way. How long were you there?
I spent 2 weeks on my first trip in Iraq and then I came back and spent 2 more weeks.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So 2 weeks at a time. Then you went back to Ukraine?
I don't remember.
What okay. happened, and then you went back to Iraq, yeah?
The reason I came back to Iraq again is that I met a client because back then developing websites was my work. And yeah, funny enough, we found a client in Iraq, which was very fortunate. And I came back to do a website for them.
Oh, okay. I wonder how that industry is now. You know, it used to be a digital nomad sort of staple. Like you can do websites, you can do it from anywhere in the world. But I think with the advent of AI and things like that now that can do that for you, I wonder how that industry is going now, like website building. Surely it's not the same as it was 5-10 years ago. And I think everybody that loves travel wants to work out a way of how to make a living while traveling.
That's correct.
Unless you get a really good paying job that you love doing, and then that allows you to to travel as well.
That's a best case scenario.
Yeah. So, and that's what you're figuring it out now, right? That's what you want to do?
That's what I used to do from the age of 17 to 21. I used to develop websites for clients and just use the most of time traveling, studying, traveling, come back home, work, save, travel.
Sure.
Multiplies that for 4 years.
And here's the thing. I'd like to know more about your home.
Mm.
Now, obviously, Ukraine's been, you know, horribly in the news over the last, you know, 2 years. Mm. Has it been 2 years?
Not yet.
Not yet. I'd like to know what Ukraine was like before all the negative experience. Like, how was Ukraine growing up and whereabouts in Ukraine were you from?
My native city is called Lviv, and it's a beautiful place, very historical. It's more than 750 years old right now. It's a city of spring, poetry, culture, coffee and chocolate.
Oh, I like it already.
Yeah, it's a kind of place you come back to and you feel like you're falling in love with anything, with life. It's a very romantic place, truly. And we have been part of many different countries. We've been part of Austria. We've been part of Soviet Union. Our city was built by Germans with Italian architecture. It's really is a melting pot of cultures. But unfortunately, I grew up in one of the Soviet neighborhoods. Not so inspiring.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if you have ever seen this kind of brutalist architecture videos. It's kind of depressive Soviet place, and that's the place I grew up in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but then I moved to a beautiful historical neighborhood full of artists, full of life when I was 17, and then it hit me like, wow, you can actually live in this city in a totally different way. Yeah. Last time I visited Ukraine was in 2022 in February.
And last year.
Yes, and I left 3 weeks sharp before the war started.
That's right.
It is heartbreaking because I could see that economy is growing. You can travel anywhere for really, really good money. People are living their best life, and Ukraine was developing. It's growing. It's just a fabulous, beautiful place to be. And having Russia invade your country and trying to destroy your people and your culture was definitely very heartbreaking, especially visiting so recently and seeing your country blossom. But we've been fighting with them for the last 400 years, so that's not a new story for us, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah, that must be horrible. And so you left, you said, 4 weeks before the war.
Three, yeah.
3 weeks. What family did you have there?
All my family was in Ukraine.
So your family, do you have many siblings?
I've got a brother and a little sister.
A brother and a little sister.
Parents, all my grandparents are alive, so they were all in Ukraine.
Now, the place you're from was on the west coast, right? Closer to...
In the west.
In the west, yeah. So when the war first started, I suppose people were a little bit more, okay, well, that's in the Donbass region, which is what they wanted on the east coast. I don't think they're going to come here. Or did your parents have a feeling, no, this is going to be all of Ukraine?
Well, the day the war started on February 24, 2022, they attacked all Ukraine with missiles. So it definitely wasn't part of Ukraine. It was the entire country, which caused a lot of panic and horror amongst population.
It's hard to comprehend. Like we're living in Australia and the West Coast in this little quaint little city.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to comprehend what that is like. When you came here today, you said, you were in Israel and Palestine. I said, yeah, 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to comprehend that the places that I was going through in Palestine and you seeing some of those places on the news now and you just think, my God, like I just can't believe that that could happen, but it happened to your town, it happened to Ukraine, and that's still going at the moment. Were you in contact with your family quite a lot?
Of course.
Did communications always work, or were they on and off?
Communications worked, yeah. When the war started, I was in Sri Lanka, coming back to Australia, and the first 10 days I was just by myself. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat. It was really tough. And especially my heart broke for my younger brother, who was 18 at the time. And back then, and still now, they have a rule that no man aged 18 to 60 can leave the country. So my brother just turned 18 a few months ago. Oh. And back then, I felt like it was the end of the world. And my mom used to send me footage of them going to the basement of the building at 3 a.m. in the morning, because there is an alarm that any time the missiles can hit your city, your building, your area. And seeing those photos of my little brother there at 3 a.m. in the morning was probably one of the most heartbreaking things from this whole experience.
And it must be hard because you're away and you can't be with them. Did you ever want to go back to be with them? I know, you know, it's like, no, I'm safe here, but my family, I know as a parent, I'd be to my daughter, don't come back.
Mm.
What was going through your
mind? It was more like I wanted them to come to me to be in safety.
Yeah. Yeah. And how are they now?
They are right. Actually, the western part of Ukraine is fairly safe. It's not completely safe because bombs and missiles can fall on your head anytime. But there haven't been any attacks for the last 2 to 3 months. And life seems to be back to normal, accepting the reality of war.
Mm. Yeah. It'll take a while, even to whatever happens with Ukraine, because we don't know what's going to happen with that war, even to rebuild what's been lost, because the whole country's been devastated. So many refugees have left, you know, they're scattered all across the world. It'd be horrible, horrible to think about your own country. Like, I can imagine if I was traveling somewhere else, and I would be looking at Perth, Western Australia, or Sydney, or, you know, on the news and seeing that. I don't know how that would be like. But so let's go after Iraq. I wanted to give the listeners a sense of, you know, not just your travel, but your home, where you came from, and also turning your life into a positive in a way that you're doing now and experiencing cultures. So where did you go after Iraq?
Honestly, I don't remember right now.
Yeah. So what about Iran? Tell me about Iran when you went, because you spent
25 days.
Wow. Iran.
Iran used to be a very fashionable destination for adventurous travelers back then. And I decided to give it all. I was like, Iran is a great country and I will travel all of it, and part of it maybe by hitchhiking and all by road. And so I ended up spending almost a month there alone as a woman. And I would say, despite its beautiful history, language, hospitality of locals, I find it quite an unsafe destination for solo female travelers. So if you're a woman listening to this, thinking about should I go to Iran or not, I would probably say think twice.
Tell us why.
Just a lot of harassment, bad harassment, which happened a lot. Yeah, to me. Yeah, and generally harassment, like people trying to grab you. And it didn't happen to me a lot, but few cases that it did happen, it did leave a very sour taste in my mouth about the whole experience in the country.
It would.
Yeah.
It would. And it's hard to sort of go to be non-biased about it, you know. I mean, sometimes you have to, because, you know, you get the odd person that will destroy it for everybody. Like I have spoken to you about, you know, you didn't have such a good time in Egypt or Israel, I think, where I had a great time in Israel and Palestine. We had no, and I don't know whether that's because you were on your own. I went with my wife and But my nephew went, and he got nailed in Israel for like 2 hours, and that's leaving the
Me
country.
Too.
Yeah,
that and entering he was, as well.
Oh, he didn't get it on entry, but he got it on leaving, and yeah, I never got any of that. So, you know, you got certain people that will go to Iran that will, like, I know some travelers that have been that absolutely love it. But then, you know, coming from a guy's perspective, and, you know, you're a young woman, you know, blonde and blue eyes, and off you go, whether that would attract a certain unwanted attention that a guy wouldn't get.
Of course, being a solo female traveler, sometimes it's a beautiful thing because people trust you more and they're less suspicious of you. And people would invite you to their homes. And then in some really conservative countries, you get access to female side as well as kids and male. Because in some gender segregated societies, such as Iraq or Pakistan, if you're a man, you would only hang out with men. So you will not see women and kids. But I get access to everything as a woman, which is beautiful. Yeah. But it has a flip side to it. You have to be really careful, communicative, cautious. And sometimes you have to deal with certain degree of harassment. I guess the older I got, the more security I could provide to myself, the more financially strong I became, the less bad stuff happened to me. But of course, it happens to women. Yeah.
How was the food similar in Iran as it was in Iraq?
No.
Oh, really?
Iraq has more Arabic influenced cuisine. At least Iran has its own unique Persian food.
Yeah. You think before the Ayatollah took over, they were very European. And I know the Shah used to go to Paris and shop there, and a lot of the women were wearing, you know, fashionable Parisian clothes, and so a lot of their foods came from different things. But I didn't know there was a massive difference between. I understand the Arabic, Iraq would be more with the Arabic side, but I didn't know that Persian food. I suppose I've had both. Yeah, I've got Persian friends, so I have a lot of food that they eat, and I've been to a lot of Arabic countries.
Nice. But usually Iranians don't like to be compared to people from Iraq because they had war in the 80s.
Sure.
And they still suffer about it. So they don't like to be put together. So
also, they're not Arabs.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't like that. Make sure you get that right if you're listening. Iranians are not Arabs. They're Persians. Yeah. I don't know why they changed their name to Iran. I love that name, Persia. Don't you?
Beautiful name.
Yeah. I love that. So from there you went, you did Iran and Iraq. Was there any other really out there adventure countries that you've traveled as a young girl?
Tajikistan.
Oh, tell us about that.
Tajikistan, my favorite country out of every place I have ever traveled to. It was part of Middle Asian adventure. When you move all the way from north, from Kazakhstan to Kyrgyzstan to Uzbekistan to Tajikistan, all the way south. And Tajikistan is a kind of country that not only outsiders don't really travel to, but people from countries that are neighboring wouldn't travel to as well, which I think is a loss.
Why is that?
When I was coming closer to Tajikistan, everyone would tell me, just don't go to Tajikistan. It's really dangerous. And then I would ask them, so have you ever been to Tajikistan? No. But I heard the story.
It's always the way, isn't it?
And when I was crossing from Uzbekistan to Tajikistan on a bus, it was a bus that would go along the border. It was just me and another woman who would hop off. And it was absolute middle of nowhere. And we walked for maybe a kilometer to actually see that border. And first thing you see is a very kind Tajik uncle with a beautiful small cup called Piala. And he says, okay, would you like some Tajik Coke? I was like, sure, let's do that. And then I see this group of motorbikers. Super cool guys and really big and intimidating. And they're like, hey, girl. And I say, oh my God, the people from Tajikistan, such bad people. I should totally ignore them. Like, I shouldn't talk to them. So I went to do my passport control. And then the border guy said to me, so have you got local money? I say, no, I don't have anything because I just crossed the border. He says, no problem. I'll call someone to come by and exchange your money. I say, okay. But I felt a bit embarrassed because I didn't have that much money to exchange. So we were just waiting for the exchange man. And after 2 minutes, he's like, you know, the exchange man's not here. Don't worry about it. I'll just give you some cash. So that's the border police.
From his own pocket?
Yeah. And here he gives me 100 Tajik somoni. And I'm coming out and I see that this place has nothing. No public transport, nothing. Just one taxi guy. And the city I had to get to was called Hujand. And the taxi guy tells me, okay, I can drop you there for $50. And it's a lot of money for Tajikistan. And it was a lot of money for me as well. And that was my only option. And then I see the gang of Tajik motorbikers.
that yelled at you, when you first got there.
Yeah, they're like, hey, where do you need to go? And I look at them and I think to myself, okay. I say, I need to go to Hujand. They're like, okay, that's on the way. You can hop on one of our motorbikes.
This could either go really good or really bad. Oh, God.
So I breathe in, leap of faith, and I say, okay, let's do it. So I'm on the back of that motorbike. We are riding from small villages. Beautiful kids come out on the street and they wave to us, hello. And long story short, I ended up staying with those motorbikers, with their families for 7 days. We crossed the country on a motorbike. We went to as high as 5,000 meters high. And this still is the most amazing adventure and my favorite country.
Wow.
Yeah, which started from the border. And then at the end, they dropped me off at the border and I was crying because how sad I was to leave Tajikistan.
So you just had a really good experience that you didn't expect.
Yes, but Tajikistan is 93% mountains. It's super non-touristic. Nobody goes there. People are so kind. Like, they are the kindest, most beautiful people. And what really struck me is someone who has so little but wants to give you everything they have. And a very underexplored place. Yeah.
It's good to know. Mm. You're saying that it's mainly mountainous regions.
93% mountains, wow. Yes.
What is it about when someone says to you, don't go, you go? What do you think? And I know what you're saying because people that normally give the most advice have never been. Mm-hmm. So I don't really listen to that. But, like I was saying to you, things are normally a metaphor for other things. Mm-hmm. What do you think that is with you? Do you just think, where does that sense of adventure, danger, where do you think that comes from?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever thought about it.
I guess maybe it's the fact that I started living alone very early at the age of 17 and I had to grow up really fast. And sometimes this makes you develop addiction to adrenaline. So
yeah,
you
okay.
want to challenge more and more. It's similar with those mountain climbers who climb K2 and then they want Annapurna 3, even though they know they can die and they still do it. I guess I'm not as reckless, but the sense of discovering somewhere raw has never left this body.
Do you think that will end someday?
It will when I die.
You know, but it's like I understand it, but you really need to look. I'll never say stop, but that can also be hard in a relationship with somebody that doesn't have that. You know, I know you're still young. You're not married.
Yeah.
But you know, there'll be a time. Like I know. Obviously, when you do get with somebody, they're going to worry about that side. Do you think it will change when you settle a little bit and go, you know, I'll still need these adventures, but do I have to be put into the danger zone in order for me to challenge myself?
I think I don't necessarily travel for danger, but I love exploring terra incognita. And I guess later in life, when I have kids, the instincts will change. But that happens later. And I don't know what happens later.
Yeah, true.
And in terms of my partner, I would always love to be with someone who understands my freedom. Otherwise, it's never going to work.
Does he love travel too?
He does, yeah. Just comfortably.
Comfort traveler. Yeah. But surely he must listen to some of your stories and go, oh, that'd be nice. Like, wouldn't mind going and doing a hitchhiking trip and in a country.
Absolutely not.
Oh, really? No, no way. And how was Saudi Arabia? You went there alone recently, right?
Yeah, a year ago. Saudi Arabia is definitely not what you think the media gives you. It's a country with one of the most educated, respectful and kind people. Yes, they have a lot of oil and they build their country to be absolute luxury. Saudi Arabia has a lot of culture. Unfortunately, I didn't travel remote enough. I just hopped from one big city to another and culture gets lost there in between oil, dust and speed. But one interesting thing about Saudi Arabians is that they love to listen music extremely loudly.
Oh, yeah?
And they like to go to bed very late. They can go to bed around 5, and then any appointment you will have in the morning will always be cancelled.
Is that because of the weather?
Yeah.
I like the place already. I'm a night owl. So I listened to that going, oh, that would really suit me. Would your experience be hindered in a way because of being a woman in a place like Saudi Arabia? Would you get as much access as a guy would, do you think?
Depending which kind of access you're looking for, if you want access just as a traveler, you can get, yes, a bit more access as a woman, I guess. But if you want to film, which was my idea in Saudi Arabia, you can't do that because the concept of privacy is huge. People do not like to share their story. They will share it privately with you, but they don't want the story to be spread.
Oh, okay.
So in terms of filming, it's very complicated in Saudi. It's only one time I have actually seen a real house where real people live, because Saudis, one interesting thing they do, they sometimes can rent an apartment between 4 friends and none of them lives there. It's just apartment for a party or shisha or inviting women. And then they would stay in a different house with really? Their parents. Yeah. So I lived in one place like that. And once I was hitchhiking in Saudi, and I was with this young man and a woman, mystery woman, because she was totally covered in black. And I had no idea who this woman was. And I assumed his wife. And once they invited me to their home, I could see a big, big, big gray fence. And it was so tall. And when you come to the house, everything is covered in gold.
And I love their gold.
Yes, and massive spaces, and the woman unveiled herself, and it actually was his mother.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then even though they couldn't speak any English, they would be like, please stay with us for the night. Please have the food.
That's so nice. Yeah, so you had a good time in Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely.
How long were you there?
Just for 9 days.
9 days. And so we come to the latest project.
Yes.
Okay, and when I met you, you said, my goal here is to do a series of short documentaries streaming on YouTube for the public. And there would be many different stories. And you were showing me this PowerPoint presentation of some of the stories you're going to. Now you're back. You've been back for 10 days, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So tell me from the beginning, like, because you went to India first.
Mm-hmm.
And from India, you went to Pakistan.
Yes.
All right. Now, difference between India and Pakistan?
There is a huge difference and a lot of similarities between India and Pakistan. Are you curious the difference culturally, a difference of doing a filmmaking project or difference of traveling as a woman in those two countries?
Let's start with culturally.
Okay. So India and Pakistan had a partition more than 70 years ago. And even though some people think, oh, the countries are really similar, they are, but it also makes a huge difference. So the main difference is religion. And Pakistani people are conservative Muslims, least in India, you can find everything. Hindus, Sikhs, Muslims, and other religions. In India, there would be a lot of vegetarian people, and the diet generally is light, at least in Pakistan. Oh my God, food is a religion. It's a love language. It's everything. And they do not know how to give a little bit of food to someone. They will always, always give you so much. And lots of meat, lots of oils, salt and spices and sugar in Pakistan. In India, it's difficult in terms of personal space. Spices are really cramped. And the biggest difference is how people, how close do people come to you. At least in Pakistan, it's the second time I'm coming back to this country, and I have never, ever had a bad experience with any kind of harassment. So it was very safe as a woman, surprisingly.
Well, you're in a conservative Muslim country. You'd expect to be safe, right?
Mostly, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you didn't feel that in India?
Oh, absolutely not.
Because of the personal space, there is no personal space there?
Yeah, when people like grab you, especially interesting thing is men, sometimes they would keep more distance, but Indian women, they find, okay, if I'm a woman and you're a woman, then we can get as close as I am comfortable. And sometimes I had experiences like someone was like taking my handbag and rummaging through my wallet and all my belongings.
An Indian woman?
Yeah. And if men want your attention, they would just come really close and say something to you. With women, they would like directly grab you. And one time I was filming an episode in a Karni Mata temple. It's a temple where they worship a goddess who is associated with rats. And back there, I had a lot of attention because you have a camera and also wearing traditional clothing. And then you have someone asking, can I take a selfie with you? Which is very common in India. And then you say yes. And then all of a sudden, there is a queue of people wanting to take a selfie with you.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, you had enough. Thank you. Okay, bye. And then I remember there was this one young boy coming to me. He was about 20. And he's like, oh, selfie, selfie. And I say, no. And he says, no, selfie. And he comes to me like trying to grab me by the neck like this. And I'm like, no. And like I had to go away and he followed me. So because of that, I didn't feel safe in India. Things like that would happen more or less every day. And I always was with someone, with a family, but as soon as they go away, it just starts. So
when you're on your own.
Yeah. So I would say depending what safety means to you, if you like your personal space, if you do not like to be touched, grabbed, and if you're a woman, yeah, maybe plan a little bit of time in India to explore it, stay in a nice hotel. But yeah, if you want to spend
sort of adventure travel,
yeah,
maybe
three
think
to
about
four
it.
Months in India, it takes a certain type of personality who can deal with things like that.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, it was really uncomfortable. Yeah, at least in Pakistan, you get personal space on a physical level.
Yeah.
But people are still like super curious, and you need to be very high energy, like talk to everyone, entertain and everything. Yeah. Similar to India.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because I have heard as well, it's quite different from the north to the south of India too.
Mm.
Especially when it comes to food, because I know that the more south you get, the more spicy the food. Yeah. Where were you in India, by the way?
I traveled,
obviously north.
I traveled only to two states, Punjab and Rajasthan.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And how long were you there?
I spent 12 days total.
Wow. Yeah. See, when I met you, I didn't even know you were going to India. I thought you were going straight to Pakistan.
Yeah.
But you went to India because it was easier to get from there to Pakistan?
Yeah. So it was two reasons. First of all, I have never been to India, and this was my sixth attempt applying for the visa, and they finally granted it.
Oh, I remember. I remember you doing refusals. The Instagram stories.
Yeah. Can anyone help me get to India? Does anyone know anyone in Indian immigration?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so I was honestly really curious. India was always on my list, and it was so close to Pakistan. So I thought, why not? The second reason, it's much more affordable to travel from Australia to India rather than directly to Pakistan.
Mm, sure.
And it's just 30 kilometers to the border. So makes perfect sense if you've got a visa.
So tell me, you didn't shoot any stories in India?
I did.
Oh, you did?
I did a story on the temple where they worship rats. And I did a more entertaining episode on what $10 can get you in India.
Oh, did you? 10 Aussie dollars?
American.
You're American.
American, yeah.
I have seen something on that rat temple.
Mm.
Yeah. I actually saw a guy talking. He does Instagram stories, but factual things about unique places.
Mm-hmm.
And when you just said that, I was like, oh, I've heard about that. I remember seeing that Instagram story on the rat temple. How did it go?
It went okay. We went. So this place is really unique. You can see 20,000 rats there, mm-hmm. but you have to come at the right time. We came in the morning, and the right time to come is the evening. Nevertheless, it's a temple, so everyone comes there barefoot, and there is lots and lots of rats running around, and rat food and rat feces and
all God.
Amazing stuff. And curiously, there are pots of milk where a rat can drink. And people believe that rats are the deceased relatives of their own. So they treat them with lots of respect, and they're not afraid of them. And they think it's a
blessing. When you say people.
Local people.
Or the local people are in that area.
The Shnok, yeah. Okay. That's the village.
Okay.
We spent maybe 3 hours and before the security guard wanted to kick us off.
Why?
Okay, so there is price list on things you want to use for filming. If you want to use a phone, this is a certain price. If you want to use a camera, you pay twice as much.
What, a phone?
Yes.
They're charging you to film on a phone?
Yes, yes.
What, in the temple itself?
Yes. If you want to take photos, it's one price. If you want to take videos, it's another price. So we paid to do a video on a camera. So it was like 100 rupees or something. And everything was good, and I was filming, and then people started taking selfies with us. And the idea was to interview a couple of people who go to the temple about what do they feel about their experience.
Selfies of us, you said, not of you. Were you with somebody?
Yes, I came with this guy from UK, which I met on a bus, and my host from the nearby city called Bikaner.
Okay, got you.
Yeah. So mostly it was selfies with me and the guy from UK. And wait, I lost my thought.
You were starting with the filming.
Ah, yes, about the being fined for filming.
Fined? You paid fine. 100 rupee.
Yes, we paid 100 rupee and to film with a camera. And when we started gathering a crowd, I thought, wow, this is a perfect opportunity to interview local people about their experience in the temple. So we got the interviews, and when we were filming the interviews, the security guard came in. It's like, oh, we need to charge you like 10 times more if you want to record interviews. And actually, I need to give you some money back as well, because I charged you 100 rupees and it actually was 80. And I was like, okay, so he's giving me money back.
But you're going to charge me so much more, 10 times more for. Oh, what a rip.
Mm. Yeah, things just don't make sense and you get used to it. The problem was that my host, he got quite intimidated by that, because what I would probably do is I would just ignore it, because people in India, they're not aggressive. They are pretty happy people, but it's sometimes difficult to understand what they actually mean. Like, I honestly struggle understanding local logic. So yeah, I would just keep filming, but because someone from my crew got really nervous, we had to wrap up and leave. Yeah.
Nervous,
yeah. Because of the threats of security guard, you gotta pay us 10 times more.
Okay. Did you get what you needed?
Honestly, I regret we didn't come in the evening, because you could see so much more rats, and there was just no way I could figure it out if someone that is local would have told me.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so let's get to Pakistan now, the place that was the target of most of your stories.
Yes. Okay. Finally, Pakistan, Zindabad.
Yeah. So where did you land in Pakistan?
Just across the border from India to Lahore.
Okay. And what was your first story?
The first story in Pakistan had to be street food of Pakistan. But unfortunately, I still had food poisoning from India. So I had to cut my filming short, and I refilmed that later. So my proper first story was joining the Sufi ceremony in one of the Sufi shrines in Lahore.
And so tell us about that. Before we get to that, food poisoning. Like, you know, it's expected in India, right?
Mm-hmm.
But being quite a seasonal traveler, you've had food poisoning before, and mm-hmm. you know, isn't it your first meal in Iraq? Do you take things for food poisoning? Do you take tablets from here for food poisoning?
I did take, yes.
To stop vomiting and things like that?
I took 10 packets of Hydrolite and I used all of them throughout my trip.
Oh, really? And what, did you need any vaccinations before you left?
I had everything I needed.
Yeah. It's normally 10 years, right?
Actually, my poisoning in India was water poisoning, not a food poisoning.
Oh, okay.
And it was super silly thing to do. Just a matter of habit, brushing my teeth in the shower. And if you ever go to India, like, common sense, do not brush your teeth in the shower.
Mm.
And somehow it fell out of my thinking process, and matter of habit took over. And I'm just brushing my teeth and then, oh my God.
Oh, you knew straight away.
I had a sip of this water. And then I was sick for 8 days.
There's nothing worse than food poisoning. Ugh.
Yeah, I mean, it was good and bad. I feel like out of all the sickness I lived through on this India-Pakistan documentary trip, this was the easiest. Because if you have food poisoning, you can still function.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I was thinking, what is the positive out of this? You're like, there's positives. You can still function.
Yeah, you can have like good rice and delicious bananas and nice probiotic yogurts. You can lose weight if you want to lose weight.
Which you did, right?
Yeah. And if you get food poisoning in India, one really good thing about it is that local people, they respect if you don't want to eat anymore. They respect that you want to stay hungry, which is fine. In Pakistan, I had to fight with people to not give me food.
Yeah. You're too thin. You need to put on weight. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your favorite story?
Oh, favorite story out of all Pakistan?
One cancelled on you, right? The wedding?
Yes, not the wedding, but my favorite story in the entirety of Pakistan was going to the Thal Desert. Thal Desert is a place is not explored on the internet. If you look at YouTube videos about Thal Desert, there is very, very little information you can get. When you tell people in Pakistan about the Thal Desert, they're like, Thar Desert? And I say, Thal, Thal, no, Thar. It's like, no, this desert exists. You actually just don't know about
it. So what's it? How do you spell it?
Thal.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's in the middle of Pakistan, southern Punjab, almost bordering with Balochistan and Sindh. And in this desert, we captured child marriage and we captured gypsy settlement. And why it was my favorite? Because all the other stories, even though they will have some unique flavor and angle to them, they have already been told. You can find something like that. But Thal Desert was completely unexplored land. And capturing things like child marriage is very rare. And capturing things like desert wedding is very rare. And dancing with gypsies in the desert is rare.
And you found out it was rare when you were there?
You just know. It's like you do your research. You do your pre-production.
Such doesn't happen every week.
Yeah, you do your pre-production. You do so much research, so many video calls, endless amount of research. And you know when some things are really already explored or really hard to find.
Sure.
Yeah. And also, how I got access to all the stories in the desert. I have a really close friend from Pakistan. His name is Adil. And he basically co-produced this project with me. He is a dentist. And because he studied in a government university, he's been stationed to work in Hyderabad Thal, a small town in the middle of that desert. And I remember one day, maybe 6 months ago, I asked him, can you find me a wedding in the desert? And this was a very atrocious thing to say.
Why?
Because I knew I could cause him a lot of trouble there and it's difficult to find a wedding somewhere there. And he thought about it and he said, yes. So what happened, every patient he had for dentistry, he would ask them, do you know of any weddings?
While they're in the chair and he's ripping out a teeth.
Yes. And I have given him a deadline towards when I want this to happen. And one thing about Pakistan is people don't plan like they plan in Australia. You can have a wedding and you don't know the date until 2 weeks from when it happens. So I have given him a tight deadline. And he tried so hard, and there were other factors about why it was difficult to find wedding, such as it was a period of Muharram, the month of mourning. And in this period, you're not supposed to celebrate anything or plan any celebrations. Mm-hmm. And long story short, we decided I'm not going there. I'm not filming a wedding. We can't plan that. It's not feasible. And when I was in Pakistan, my initial plan was to spend last few days of my trip in one of the big cities, just doing post-production, relaxing, pickups, all that stuff. And when I was there, I was like, no, I need to go to the desert. So I call him up and I say, Adil, this is the days I have free. Do you have any wedding? He says, there is a wedding right on those dates.
And how did it go? Like, how did you get amazing footage?
You get kind of footage you don't really see on the internet. And I have seen other desert weddings from Pakistan, just different deserts like Cholistan, for instance. And it's filmed by men and you see the men's side.
Yeah.
As a woman, you come there and you can film everything.
I see. I never thought of that until you were saying the positives of being a woman and a video camera. Mm. Is you do. You get access to both. But as a guy, yeah, it's true. I'd only have access to the men.
Yes.
Interesting. What did you learn from this experience that you've taken with you? And what were some of the things that you thought, if you had to do it again, this is what I'd do differently?
Mm-hmm. From entire documentary project?
Yeah.
I have learned that sometimes camera gives you access to stories. Before, I thought that coming with a camera to someone's home, to someone's face, can make them feel very intimidated. But sometimes when you have your camera, it gives you the opportunity to listen to someone's story and people want to share. sometimes when I needed to interview people off the street, I would just be there and they would just come. They would just invite you, just come and tell their story. That's one thing I learned. Another thing is you can be as strong as you want to be, but everything has a capacity. Everything has a capacity. And you can push really hard until it's too hard. And
give me an example.
For me, it was working when I was sick because the schedule was so tight, 6 weeks, 11 stories. And some stories needed like 3 days to film. And it's like nonstop working through sickness. But sometimes it really is too much. And that's a question of whether you want to stop and when you should stop.
I do remember you telling me how many projects you were, and then how long you were going for. And I came home going, you know, like, because in documentary, I know that there's your way and then there's God's way. And God's way always wins. You know, like suddenly a typhoon would come and monsoon rains and you're like, oh, you know, I'm shooting this. And so, yeah, but that's just expected when you're doing documentary. So maybe next time would you have a bit more like a B plan of, all right, we're going to do filming here, but we're going to have 2 days off and then filming here. And if we need an extra day, we've got one of those days, but at least you get your rest.
That was the case even with the current project. I planned for some days off, and a lot of times I use those days off to pick up extra stuff.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
So did you get everything you needed?
Everything I am content with, yes. There is always more things you need, but generally, yes.
And so the question number two was the second part of that. What would you do differently this time if you went back?
I would pay more attention to sound because that was always my concern.
You had the Rode, right? The Rode video mic too?
Yes, I had really good mic, on camera mic, but Pakistan is a sort of a place that's super noisy. Like life is happening all the time, the honks, the dust, the people, the screaming. And those kind of noise conditions, it's a bit tough. But what I'm currently doing in post-production, there is this really cool software from Adobe. It's AI podcast editing.
I know the one.
And you can really take...
isolate the voice.
Yeah, a lot more sound.
But then again, you know, like we were saying outside, that can be also part of the madness of Pakistan, you know, having that sound in there. Sometimes it's when you cut too much of it out, you're not getting that sense of realism of people that have visited or that live there will go, no, it's crazy here. But maybe that will give a bit more, you know, texture to the documentary, having that madness as well.
Absolutely. There is a lot of madness and a lot of sound coming out of Pakistan. I mean more like parts when I was talking to a camera. And it's just super noisy.
Yeah. So, which you can't really, unless you choose your spot differently, but if you're saying it's just crazy everywhere you go, you just got to...
Some episodes.
So would you post-production, how long have you given yourself?
3 months to finish all of it.
Okay. And have you got a YouTube page?
I'm gonna create one as soon as I post the first episode, which hopefully is gonna be this week.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll put it in the show notes. I'll put the link down in the show notes of your page, Instagram and things like that. You've got the bug to go do more filming. Is there anything on your sights in the future in a country that you're thinking, I wouldn't mind going there and exploring?
Now I contracted not just a travel bug, but I contracted a documentary filming bug.
Yeah.
This is... serious. For now, my main priority is to complete this journey, you know, finish post-production, put it out, see how people react to it. Is there any interest? Is there a lot of interest? Where it takes this project, where it takes my life? And upon completion, I will decide whether I would love to do another project similar to this.
Yeah. Do you know, that would be a cool idea, is having, like you said, the street food, then you go to another country and do similar, like a wedding, and you're seeing the cultural differences between similar stories, you know, that you can compare.
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea to mix popular stories that get a lot of views with something that's much more difficult to find.
Mm.
I guess the amount of gratification you get from going remote and off the beaten track and capturing that story, knowing that, wow, this is quite unique content.
Yeah.
It's difficult to beat with some kind of popular content.
But yeah, it's also a fine balance of, this is something you want to do. It's not necessarily what just other people need and what you think they need.
That's
and what
correct,
the views.
Yes.
I think number one should be what you want, and then hopefully it sinks in with the public.
Yeah.
There's something you said to me in the cafe before you left, and I never thought about it until you said it, was that Pakistan have a huge population that follows these videos. And you actually gave me an example. There was another video that was done and it got so many million views or whatever.
Mm.
Never thought about that.
Mm.
So I think, you know, you obviously, when you do something, you think about your own country. But no, you're filming in Pakistan.
Mm.
From a foreigner's perspective coming in, Pakistan people would love to see that.
Yes.
So you could be really lucky in getting that from Pakistan. Yeah. But, you know, doing more things like this and podcasting and promoting and setting up, keep your Instagram stories going, joining more groups, and you got to treat the opening like a premiere of a film.
Mm.
You know, even a podcast, something as simple as a podcast, no one really watches the podcast. People listen to it. I know that. But how the podcast grew was by the previews that I would do. I'd cut little snippets and then put titles to them and put them on Facebook and Instagram. People saw that and then would listen to the podcast. So you treat your first episode like a premiere and really start promoting it now, and then having a schedule that you could follow.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to put one out in a week and then 2 weeks later you'll put another one, but let people know that as well. So
absolutely. The plan is to put one episode out each week.
Mm.
And the first episode that comes out is going to be, why do people in Pakistan drive the way they drive?
Yeah.
Trying to understand the bizarre culture of moving on the road, not wearing any helmets and having five people on the motorbike.
And you've seen that in other cultures though too, right?
Never as intense as it is in Pakistan.
Southeast Asia?
Maybe. There is stuff like that to a certain degree, but Pakistan really struck me. And what's striking about driving culture in Pakistan, that a lot of people are actually fine with that and they defend it, and then it's good and it's safe enough. And that's why, because I had this conflict with people, I decided to make an episode. And in terms of post-production, this has been one of the most challenging, because there is a lot of interviews, translations, and I've been working on it for a while. But there would be a lot of episodes which are much more straightforward in terms of editing. So, yeah.
I was going to, that's translation.
Mm.
I didn't think about that. It's an obvious thing.
Mm.
So you had a translator with you. Was it the dentist guy?
Yes, he just interviewed people, and then I have a translator who just helped me in post-production. Yeah.
Okay.
She's a professional translator.
Okay. Oh, that's good. And so subtitles and things, getting on some really popular Pakistan groups as well would really help, because you really want to promote it over there.
It's a really good idea. Yeah, Pakistan Facebook group.
I remember you saying to me the first negative thing that you got when you were traveling. You went on a Facebook group and you put something there and you got hammered, you know, but it's actually a good thing. Like, you, as in, set up a group or join really popular Pakistan groups and promote it there and let them do the work for you and promote it and share and things like that.
Mm.
But I think that's a great idea. Is, you know, hopefully it becomes huge in Pakistan, because all you need is the views, and then it will slowly grow and grow and grow. And by then, you know, you'll be in your second country doing another documentary or whatever.
As they say in Pakistan, Inshallah.
Yeah,
hopefully.
Yeah. Inshallah. Yeah. So do you have an idea where you want to go next?
I just give myself some time to think. But I have two ideas. If I ever come back to Pakistan, there are two largely underexplored regions called Sindh and Baluchistan. And it would be absolutely superb to do a sequel and capture their stories.
Okay.
Absolutely superb. But if I would go away from Pakistan, I am currently looking at the map of Africa. Just thinking about it.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard some fantastic things about different regions and different countries within the African continent. That would be great. Did you take, now for the gear nerds,
mm-hmm.
what are you using?
I used Sony A7S3 with Sony 24 1.4 GM and 85
1.8. Okay. Oh, so you had two really fast lenses.
Yeah.
Balls. Oh, good.
I like shooting on fixed lenses.
I do too.
Yeah. Even if it comes to documentary where everyone tells you, take zoom, which is sound advice. But that 24 1.4, I barely took it out of my camera. Beautiful image and lets you capture everything you need closely. Mm. And it's really good because I also had an on-camera mic. It's called ECM B1M from Sony. And that's how I captured majority of the sound.
Do you know, it's interesting you say that, because there is a difference. I used to have a Zoom that I used to go and do work with. And it was called the Holy Trinity. So I had the 16 to 35, the 24 to 70, and then the 70 to 200. But I found doing photography now and listening to some of the most famous street photographers from Europe and things, there is something about a 24 to or 35 fixed lens in terms of you are within the environment. You know, you're not a spectator zooming in there, and you can feel it when you watch it.
Mm.
And I do a lot of street photography now, and it's so different. Like I filmed a protest rally, and I saw guys with zoom lenses, but they were on the outside. I was in front of the person, and they're showing me things and you become part of that, and you feel it within the photos. So, you know, when you said, I mean, the 85s are great, even a portrait lens. Or mm-hmm. photography, but I thought you'd use the 24 more.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. for everything, yeah.
Did you have a drone?
This is one of my regrets. I was deliberating a lot of time whether you can take a drone or not. The trick was that you can freely use drone in Pakistan, but in India, you are not supposed to use a drone. And the story is that you can't get a license. Most people could never get the license, so it's not a very feasible path. And the story is whether they take your drone away on a border or not.
That's the
and you know what?
Worry.
They never ever checked any of my luggage.
Oh, really? But you don't know. You really don't. You're taking a massive risk.
Yeah. I guess having a drone would be really good, but at the same time, not having a drone is still all right.
Mm.
Yeah. I thought it would be more of a tragedy than it actually was, not having a drone.
Mm. If you went back, would you take one?
Yes, I think it's just a question of the risk. Are you ready to sacrifice your drone for the Indian border?
A couple of grand, yeah. Yeah, I know. And they're getting more and more strict with drones all around the world now.
Mm.
So when I bought my drone, yeah, I was taking it everywhere. And I had no problems except Egypt, because they wouldn't allow it.
Mm.
But I heard some horror stories. I heard one guy getting taken away in a van. They let him go, but they confiscated his drone. They fined him $2,000 and he wasn't allowed back in the country. He flew his drone over the pyramids, right? So obviously, but okay. He was like 4 kilometers away. But no, he got picked up. And I've heard some stories, so I didn't risk it either. I didn't take it to Egypt.
Egypt is too much of a risk, yeah.
Yeah, I think countries, you've got to sort of do a bit of research and go, yeah, maybe I can and maybe I can't. But like you said, I don't think you need to. You think documentaries have been made before drones came out. And if you're getting those more personal feelings and personal shots, you know, I think it's good. Sometimes in establishing, especially in a desert, to get that vastness and space and emptiness and, you know, a nice shot. One very experienced producer and director said to me this. He said, Wayne, when you're doing a drone shot, don't just do an aerial shot looking down. He goes, it's really nice to get in a horizon to give you that perspective. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a horizon and so you're not too much above, but you're a little bit down so you can see the person, see the horizon, but you're up in the air. And I never forget that. So when I was in Greece, I'd often get these beautiful like horizon shots and I wouldn't put my drone too far up.
Yeah, you make me regret so much right now.
No, your journey's just starting, right? So, that's fantastic. So nice to hear like everything. I know it's not everything, but a lot of the stories. But I was also more interested to hear about some of the other travels that you've done, which you spoke about. And maybe like, you know, come back in, you know, 6 months and then or where after post-production. And then maybe next year when you're doing, before you go on a holiday on your documentary and then come back and then we can compare notes and hopefully push your product and give it a bit of a boost in the promotion area, you know. Can you give a name for the YouTube site that you're going to have, the YouTube page?
I reckon I'll just name it after my personal name, which is Irena Yaminska.
I think so.
Yeah.
I'll just learn how to say the name properly. Irena.
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 Well done. Well done.
And I'll put it in the show notes anyway so people can have a look on the show notes. And thank you so much for coming on. I loved having chat always about travel and more so filming and travel both together. Always a pleasure.
Amazing talking to you. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for inviting me. And it's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for coming on. And hopefully we'll hear you again.
Yeah.
Okay, bye.